Good morning, everyone. So the swine flu is one of the headlines this morning. There's also pictures of tornadoes on the television screen. If you're watching the news, there's, severe weather, severe concerns about swine flu. There's an outbreak in Mexico. We're going to be continuously updating you throughout the morning. We'll have experts and reporters on. We want to know what questions you have about the swine flu story that really blew up over the weekend. 877-8-MY-TAKE for your questions, or mytake@thetakeaway.org. But why do I mention swine flu and severe weather? Because if you're like me, you like to conflate a lot of these stories about pandemics and epidemics and that sort of thing and severe weather with climate change. The world is warming up. That has all kinds of implications for all sorts of things. Well, today, 17 governments are going to begin meeting at the Major Economies Forum in Washington. It's all about the Kyoto Protocols and whether climate change policy changes are actually something a global consensus can be found to pursue with the United States in the tent as opposed to outside the tent during the Bush administration. Joining us to talk about the Kyoto Protocol is Andrew Revkin, New York Times climate change reporter. But I couldn't help, since we have you here in the studio, Andrew, and thanks for coming in. And thanks for not shaking my hand when you came in the door, as your colleague did a moment ago. Is it wrong to think that when stories like epidemics, in this case, we're just talking about an outbreak of the swine flu in Mexico at this point, severe weather, diseases, that sort of thing, that climate change is really behind the scenes at work here?
It's wrong.
It's wrong.
It's wrong.
I should not worry about this.
Well, it depends on your time scale. We live at a time when climate change, the changes that could come and are starting to emerge, according to most scientists, from the human impact on the climate are going to take generations still to unfold in a way where you could sort of point to some particular extreme, whatever, you name it, cold spell, hot spell, and say, aha, that's us.
What about human mobility?
Well, that's The reality is we live at a one-time spike in our numbers. In 1830, there were only 1 billion people on planet Earth. Now there are 1 billion teenagers on planet Earth. There's close to 7 billion, and we're heading toward 9 billion people. And we're urbanizing at the same time. We've just become a mainly urban species for the first time in our history. And, of course, mobility is unprecedented. So things that happened in 1918 can happen now in a month in terms of getting – if there's some particularly nasty pathogen out there that likes to hitch rides, it can be around the world in a matter of hours.
Literally. And in 1918, you're referring to the flu pandemic, of course, which killed 100,000 around the world when it
hitched
hitched rides all over, and we didn't have the global mobility that we have now. But let's talk about Kyoto then for a moment. With climate change on an upward trend, global warming is understood to be trending upward by all of the industrialized nations. What are the political dynamics as these 17 governments begin meeting in preparation for some sort of real protocol? Is it all about China and the United States?
Yes.
Yes.
The two gorillas in the greenhouse are these two extraordinary countries. One is still quite poor. When we look at China from here and we see this emerging powerhouse economically, but still, in terms of per capita income, it's a fraction of our income and a fraction of our emissions of these greenhouse gases, which come from burning fossil fuels. And so in China, there's a very strong sense still that it's our obligation, having spent 200 years getting rich burning fossil fuels, to step first on this route towards some new agreement.
Now, that was a very politically inflammatory disagreement that caused the Bush administration to back away, saying we're not going to just destroy our economic development for this silly Kyoto climate protocol. The situation has changed significantly now, and we're in the middle of an economic downturn.
Yeah, although the actual dynamics that led to the Bush administration rejecting it haven't changed at all. The problem is President Obama, as with Bush and as with Clinton, they have to deal with the Senate. Any new treaty has to get approval of two-thirds of the Senate. So that's a big number of senators to have on board. And the Senate since 1997 has said affirmatively, repeatedly, that any treaty that doesn't include concrete obligations, commitments from China and the other large developing countries is a non-starter.
So essentially China and the rest of the 17 governments are speaking to Richard Shelby in the Senate?
In a way, you have this weird dynamic where so there's a shackle on the president's leg saying you can't anything you do. And actually, Todd Stern, the president's climate envoy, essentially said this. We have to have a treaty this time that we know is adoptable here. we're not going to make the mistake that was made in 1997 of Kyoto, where we have a rush to an agreement that we know will never pass muster at home. And that, so there you have this
pragmatism,
real tough, but it's a real tough situation, right, basically.
So is it possible that as the 17 governments sit down, that the world economy has actually done them all a favor, and that the global downturn actually has a positive impact on carbon emissions, on global warming, that the recession is going to do what none of these world leaders has the will to do on their own?
It's pretty clear. I just was listening to the radio this morning on the way in, and there's a 30% drop in what we send to landfills right now. So that means guaranteed emissions of the greenhouse gases have slowed as well. And this could either be seen as an opportunity, but it also can be a bigger problem for two reasons. One is, you know, we're consumed with other things right now, rebuilding the economy. In places like China, they've talked about having a green aspect to their rebuild of their economy, as we have. But the imperative is still about growing the economy. And then,
but is there a green dimension to growing the economy that can actually be put into policy on both the Chinese side and the U.S. side?
More so here. We have the wealth and the technology to build a cleaner power plant than one that might otherwise be built. In China, they're still saying, if you want us to build a cleaner power plant, we're very happy to do so if you help us pay for it.
If you help us pay for
it. Yeah, and so how do you get the Senate again or Congress generally on board at a time of economic trouble? Now, and again, with the issue sort of on a back burner, and the polling shows that, you know, the average person now, this is so far off.
So far down, right?
It never was a high priority, and now it's far down the list. Today, this morning, Obama is giving a speech at the National Academy of Sciences on the importance of invigorating our scientific enterprise. That's a vital aspect of whatever happens in this world if we're going to respond effectively to climate. So we'll see what comes from that,
right,
too.
And the recession, possibly a green opportunity, but it'll be discussed by the 17 governments who begin meeting at the Major Economies Forum in Washington. Andrew Revkin, New York Times environmental reporter specializing in climate change. Thanks for talking about it with us. Femi Okeh has the headlines.
Thank you very much, John. The time is 21 minutes to the top of the hour.